And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Born during the despair of the Great Depression, tempered by the fires of the Second World War, on a parallel Earth very much like our own, yet slightly different, they're banded together the greatest forces for freedom ever assembled. Over the many ensuing years, new and younger members would join the veteran champions of the Golden Age, continuing their fight for truth, justice, and the American way. Becoming so much more than just heroes, they became legends. Back to the Bins proudly presents Legends of the Justice Society of America.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins presents Legends of the Justice Society of America. I'm Paul Spataro, and I am here with my society brethren, Mr. David Pasquarella.
How are you? Good to be here again.
It's good to be back with you again. And Mr. Scott H. Gardner.
Hello.
I don't have anything that H stands for today. It's just an empty initial floating in the air.
Yes, it is. Oh, I'm
Scott,
excited for this.
I don't know. Horatio Hornblower Scott Gardner.
You know, this, you know, everything just is, you know, flows seamlessly to the listener. They never know about the behind the scenes things, but
so tell them. Go ahead.
I'm excited. We're back. I'm excited for this. You know, it's been a bit of a delay for various reasons for getting to these Legends episodes, but here we are. We're back, and we're going to try our damnedest to get back on schedule with this and keep forging forward. So yeah, with this one, this one's exciting because now we've got the next of the JLA-JSA crossovers, so this one should be a lot of fun. I'm very curious what the reactions are going to be to this particular one, so yeah.
I have some mixed thoughts about it, and we'll we'll get into it as we go on.
Yep.
Excellent. This is my favorite show we do.
Me too. You have the first synopsis, my friend.
Okie doke. Let's jump into this. All right. We are doing this week Justice League of America number 46. Cover dated August 1966. I wasn't even a thought in anybody's eye yet. Cover price a mighty 12 cents. Talk about inflation. And the title of our issue is Crisis Between Earth 1 and Earth 2. Written by Gardner F. Fox. Penciler Mike Sikowski. Inker Sid Green. And edited by Julie Schwartz. And our roll call is from the Justice League of America: Batman, Flash, Green Lantern, and Hawkman. There's also a cameo by the Atom, but we don't actually see the Atom, just Ray Palmer. And from the Justice Society of America: Black Canary, Dr. Fate, Dr. Midnight, Sandman, Spectre, and Wildcat. Hurtling toward collision, destruction with each other, are Earth 1 and Earth 2. Striding toward those Earths comes another world-shattering menace from the antimatter universe. But wait, there's more. Add in the Fiends, Blockbuster, and Solomon Grundy. And we open our story on the twisting roads of Moro Mountain. Hawkman pursues hijackers of an Acme fur truck. I kind of wonder if it's going to just explode with a coyote chasing after it. As heavy fog rolls in, Hawkman loses sight of the truck. When the fog thins, an armored truck has replaced the fur truck, and gunfire greets the hero. He makes short work of the criminals and just figures when they regain consciousness, he'll gain answers on how they pulled this switcheroo. Again on Moro Mountain, another grim figure is bursting with questions as his sand car hurtles after a fleeing vehicle. The Sandman ponders how the armored car he was pursuing became an Acme fur truck. Beep, beep. Sandman runs the truck off the road, assuming with no evidence whatsoever that the occupants are criminals. He uses an oddly shaped energy rod, flashing a torrent of heat and water at drifting grains of matter. The thugs are quickly overpowered and confused as to where Hawkman went and who this costumed guy is. Sandman assumes his absence from crime fighting is the reason he's not recognized. Meanwhile, somewhere on Earth 2, Dr. Midnight interrupts a robbery, using his psychro-tuba to shock the dastardly duo. However, a third cretin opens fire on Dr. Midnight from inside the bank vault. Luckily, the Dark Doc is able to use his cryo-probe to freeze the felon's firing hand. Forget those blackout bombs, he's got new tech. Midnight has a whole new arsenal. As the crime crusader leaps forward to round up his prisoners, he finds himself whirled around violently and incredibly. Suddenly, he's on Earth One, nabbed by the Flash of Earth One. Flash is equally shocked as he was about to apprehend some bank robbers. Elsewhere on Earth One, Batman batters some jewel thieves, who are suddenly replaced by Wildcat. Here and there, on Earth 1 and Earth 2, ordinary people are having difficulty with similar eerie changeovers. On Earth 2, the Black Canary's pursuit of a burglar across a rooftop winds up in a marshland with the Earth 1 Green Lantern. All over Earth 1 and Earth 2, People are being whisked between worlds. As the Spectre responds to a threat from asteroids, he feels a strange tug on him and vanishes. Not far away, some fantastic force shatters the prison holding Solomon Grundy, and he hurtles towards Earth. On Earth One, in the secret sanctuary of the Justice League of America, Earth One's Flash, Green Lantern, and Hawkman meet up with Black Canary and Dr. Midnight. They find themselves stumped with the transfers between Earths and their strange inability to return. As the heroes agree to team up, Solomon Grundy rampages, searching for his hated foe, the Green Lantern of Earth 2, Alan Scott. Simultaneously, the imprisoned Blockbuster vanishes from Earth 1 Gotham City and appears free on Earth 2. In Ivytown, Ray Palmer the Atom receives an emergency signal, but claims his size and weight controls aren't functioning and can't assist. Or maybe it's the hot Italian girl exchange scientist he's working with. The combined heroes track down and battle the swamp monster. After individually trying to stop Solomon Grundy, who has been supercharged with the powers of Dr. Fate and Green Lantern from the prison they imprisoned him in, the heroes actually team up and capture Grundy within a mountain. Meanwhile, the Spectre has been drawn between worlds, on the borderlands of everywhere and nowhere. He confronts an antimatter alien, who, if he enters our universe, it will result in instant destruction. Each blow the Spectre lands on the alien results in a terrible warping of his body. As he pursues the antimatter man to Earth, he discovers that Earth 1 and Earth 2 are on a collision course. Spectre stretches himself to enormous size and holds the two Earths apart with his body. On Earth 2, Earth 1's Batman and Sandman, Wildcat, and Dr. Fate face off against Blockbuster. Instead of listening to Batman, who knows only in his guise as Bruce Wayne can he subdue Blockbuster, each of the JSAers tries and fail. When Blockbuster sees the face of Wayne, who had once saved his life, he becomes docile. The JSA reassures Wayne that his secret identity is safe with them. As the heroes ponder their next step, the antimatter man continues his death march towards Earth, and the specter, compressed between the two Earths, shrinks ever smaller. To be continued. Well, what do we think of that?
Just so the listeners know, we are doing these, old-fashioned style. I did consult the historical notes for each of these issues. There wasn't really anything on this particular issue. I'm trying to remember if there is for the next one as well, but there really wasn't anything of note on this. So all my notes are just my own observations on this one. Just real quick, I dug it. I think the art is better than it has been in the Mike Sekowski issues that we've looked at up to this point. It still has that cartooniness and everything to it, but the anatomy has definitely gotten better. It's not my preferred style. He's not one of my preferred artists, but at least it's better than it has been in the past. It's a little more solid than it was. I don't know how you guys feel. What did you think of this?
I like the interior art. I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah.
What's up with Blockbuster's hair? What is that? Did he just come out of the beauty parlor? What's going on here?
He got a perm just for the occasion.
He got that, what was it, Breck shampoo he's using.
But I thought just on a whole, not talking about the artwork, but on a whole, this issue, it almost feels like somebody retroactively was listening to me and where I was saying, these things aren't earth-shattering enough. There's not enough at stake. And I have mixed feelings because I do think that the effort was made here to make this more of a cosmic story that was, on a grand scale, but it still contains some silliness about it. Like, it's almost like I want to make the stakes high, but I don't want to take it too seriously. So it's almost at conflicting ends. So for that reason, I feel like it doesn't totally work for me. But it wasn't bad. I'm just giving you my criticism as I see it in this thing. Also, there is an Earth 2 Batman, so their explanation that they're going to keep his secret identity because he's from Earth 1 doesn't really hold water.
Unless they didn't know his identity. I thought about that too. Is like, did they really at this point not know the secret identity of Batman, like of each other? I mean, they've been teammates now for all these years since, World War II. Do they really not share IDs with each other? But
Wildcat says to us, you revealed your true face to us. Well, it doesn't matter since we're on Earth 2 and you're on Earth 1.
Right.
So on Earth 2, there still is Bruce Wayne as Batman.
Right.
So that doesn't give me any kind of comfort level. Also, when you factor in the fact that Bruce Wayne is a very, very public figure, so I can't buy the they don't know who he is thing.
Right.
Unless they just assume, like Jay Garrick is Flash and Barry Allen's Flash, maybe, there's another Barry Allen on Earth 2 who sells insurance or something.
Right. I don't know. My no prize for it would just simply be that, they were being courteous, because at this point there's still not mention of Earth 1 or excuse me, of Earth 2 Batman and Superman or any of the heroes yet. We haven't gotten that duplication yet. I think that is coming soon though.
The next is the next crossover, the one where Robin.
Yes. Yeah.
Is that the one with the gray suit?
Yes.
Yeah, Robin's got kind of the composite Batman and Robin costume.
Yep. Yeah, and I think that's the one that for the first time hints at there being, I believe, both Earth 2 Batman and Earth 2 Superman, I believe. It's that one.
And then Earth 2 Dr. Fate, Sandman, and Wildcat are saying, oh, geez, that's what that guy was. You remember last time, you know, when we were fighting that guy with the hair?
See, it is silly, you know, in a lot of aspects and everything, you know, but I think it's much better than the cover would lead you to believe, because the cover just screams Batmania. I mean, this was right at the height of Batmania. So right on the cover, you've got, you know, very cartoons. I think Solomon Grundy looks like he's right off of Scooby-Doo. He looks like, yes, a Scooby-Doo ghost villain instead of Solomon Grundy. But you've got Solomon Grundy and Blockbuster knocking about Wildcat, Batman, and Sandman, and you've got the actual pop-up word, you know, the sound effects, just like on the Batman TV show. You've got pow, sock, thud. And so, to me, as soon as I saw this, I was like, oh God, this is going to be, you know, that sort of thing. But it's really, I don't think it is. I think they did that on the cover and a little bit during the issue because of the Batman TV show. But that's about the extent of the damage, you know, to that. You know, overall, I think they were playing it a little more straight. And yeah, that was my very first note, is, you know, right on the very first, you know, on the splash page, when it says, you know, hurtling toward destruction, hurtling toward collision, rather, destruction with each other, are Earth 1 and Earth 2. You know, that was my note, was, well, this is the level that Paul's been talking about right here.
it's reaching for it. It's just not quite grasping it yet.
Right.
But it's headed in the right direction, so I'm kind of cool with that.
Now, do either of you guys have this one?
No.
No?
Only in reprints.
Yeah.
So I got this one off eBay back on October 18th of 2022 for $12.51.
Wow. Nice.
Yeah, not too bad. About what it's about the going rate on this.
I would have thought it would go for a little higher than that, actually. I would have thought this would be like a kind of, you know, I would have thought about double that, like about a $25 book.
I think you can get it for that, but I'm Mr. Bargain Hunter. So.
He's well, so
am I, but I'm, but so am I. But when I find it for a bargain, I don't in my mind set that bargain price as being the standard.
Right. No, I see what you're saying.
So I'm thinking this is a $25 book that you found for about half the price.
Right. Yeah. I think you're right. I think that is more the going rate, honestly. Well, just flipping through here, got some notes here. Page 2, last panel, where Hawkman is baffing that guy in the face with a what is that called?
The mace. Oh, the mace.
Is it a mace?
That guy's head is collapsing.
Yeah, I'm just like, that would kind of hurt. Yeah, that would, you know, cave his face in pretty much. This is the first Silver Age appearance of the Sandman. His last appearance was 20 years prior to this in Adventure Comics number 102.
Wow, he got cut relatively quick, Sandman, huh?
Say that again?
He got cut relatively quick.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
I feel like a little more splash is done here with him reappearing, but still, you know, I'm still kind of shocked by the lack of fanfare with these guys returning after such long absences, but at least he kind of gets his own sequence in this.
What's great is they brought him back in his original costume too.
Right.
Well, you compare this to the Marvel reappearances of their Golden Age characters, and Marvel's Golden Age wasn't nearly as prolific as DC's, but like when the Submariner came back, that was a big deal. When the Captain America came back, that was a big deal.
Yep.
This is it's almost like an afterthought.
Exactly. Yeah, they're just not making much fanfare about it at all, honestly. I think the sand car both looks really cool and sounds really dumb at the same time. It actually looks in that panel, the middle panel on page 3, is the car actually like sandy? Because it looks like it's got like some grit or something on the hood and everything. So is it actually supposed to be like a sand car? Because that's really ridiculous.
If you look, somebody used their finger and they wrote "wash me" on it.
Yeah, I think he's just too cheap to get it cleaned. I don't think it's supposed to be sand.
There is no kind way to say this. So I'm just going to say it. These sand powers are stupid. They are really stupid. I have watched professional glass blowers. Blown glass is scalding hot. And he blows glass bubbles onto these guys to disarm them. So wouldn't it just basically just lop their hands off?
Yes.
And he puts...
Well, at least it would take it to the bone.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, he's putting these freshly blown glass bubbles over their gun hands. And you would think they'd be like screaming in agony. So, yeah, I'm not sure how that whole thing is supposed to work, but
prior to this, he just had the gas gun, right? Or did they change that?
I'll be honest, I don't know enough about him to really know if this was, you know, a gimmick he had back in the day. I mean, I remember the gas gun. I remember the sand thing, you know, where he would like throw sand in people's faces to make them sleepy or something. Right. Whether he had this glass blowing ability or not, I don't know. But yeah, I'm not sure how this is supposed to work. I mean, clearly that's fire coming out when he's doing the thing there with on the bottom of page 3. I mean, that's like fire. I assumed it was fire, and then you said fire and water, so maybe that is water. I thought it was fire, and then the substance there that looks like water, I thought was glass forming from him blowing the flame onto the sand particles in the air. That's what I thought was happening, but maybe I'm wrong. But one way or the other, I mean, freshly blown glass is hot.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure.
Or usually the edges are a little, you know, like, you know, they're very easy to cut you.
Right.
Even if somehow it's cooled off. I got a kick, and I probably shouldn't have because it's a little dopey, but I got a kick out of the disproportionate specter. When he gets bopped on the head, I found that amusing. And then is it in this one? No, it might be in the next issue where they make his feet really big.
I think that's the next one. Yeah. Dr. Midnight's constant medical puns really got on my nerves through this entire thing. You know, where he comes running in at, when we first see him, he comes running in at the bottom of page 4 and he says, I diagnosed this case as a bank robbery. Now I'm here to opera. And I'm like, oh God. And he does this through the entire adventure. And it just really got on my nerves. And, you know, just when I think Dr. Midnight can't get any lamer, then he comes up with, now, I was with you, Dave. I keep pronouncing it in my mind. I keep pronouncing it cryotuber, but it's actually chirotuber, which is even dumber.
You're right.
It's got to be the dumbest name for a gadget yet. And it even looks ridiculous. So I could be wrong. I don't think we ever see this thing again after this adventure, but I'm going to be keeping an eye out for that now.
I don't think he ever had it before either.
No, he didn't. Like... No, it's new to this, but I think it... I don't think it hit with anybody because I don't remember him ever using it again.
What did you think of my new gadget? They suck.
They suck. Go back to your gas bomb. Now, you know, where he uses it at the bottom of page 5 and freezes the guy's hand solid, then cryotuber would kind of work if that was what it was actually called, because he's using like a freeze gun type of power, like cryonics type of thing.
Right.
But it's I don't get chirotuber. I don't understand that at all.
I think we're right, and they wrote it.
Yeah, backwards. Could be.
He bought it in Cairo.
Right.
And this guy lost his hand too when it was frozen.
Yes, because he says yes. I'm glad you said that, because he says he's using solid. He says something about just as the chirotuber can change warm flesh to solid ice with liquid nitrogen during an operation, so can my chirotuber. And I'm like, you know, I looked this up. Skin contact with liquid nitrogen can result in burns, blistering, and severe frostbite injury, which can occur within seconds of exposure. So, yeah, this guy probably lost his hand because of blind idiot here. So.
It's a price I'm willing to pay.
Oof. Here's your nitpick of the issue. Page bottom of page six, where Batman is fighting the bad guys, and then all of a sudden they vanish, and Wildcat pops in. Wildcat immediately says, "Hold it." He goes, "What am I doing battling Batman?" And then Batman says, "Wildcat, how'd you get mixed up in this? They should not know each other. They have not met. Unless there was a meeting that we were just never privy to that happened at some point that, you know, like an untold adventure type of thing. But up to this point, as we've seen these adventures, they have not met."
It also looks like he's clocking Julius Schwartz in the panel above.
Right. It does look like Julius Schwartz. You're right. Oh, that's funny. My next note's not till way on page 10. So if you guys have anything in the interim, there's a mention here. It's in the last panel where it shows what the hell's going on here. Solomon Grundy's breaking free from the lab. It says something about Gotham City's Alfred Memorial Foundation that eventually becomes the Wayne Foundation. And I think that's because at the time in the, I think Alfred died for a time. I think this was right around the time he died. And then he came back as like the outsider or something. Does that sound familiar?
Vaguely.
I think.
Vaguely.
What's the purpose of the Atom scene in this? I didn't quite get that. I know he becomes important in the next issue, but here it's almost like it's just filler. Is this just like to show that he's going to be part of the adventure or something? Because it doesn't really.
That's what I took it for. I think it was just to kind of keep him as part of the storyline.
Right.
What are we going to do with him? We don't want him just showing up in the next issue to be, you know, out of the clear blue sky. So let's give him something to do in this issue.
And let's give him a hot Italian girl.
So page 13, first panel, you've got the Flash running at Solomon Grundy, and he's spinning his arms in kind of a, you know, like a cheerleader fashion or something, and generating this this storm. Now, I know he does this sort of thing all the time, but looking at this panel, I think this is the first time it ever occurred to me, and I was wondering, how many hurricanes has this asshole accidentally caused, you think, by doing this sort of thing? Because he does this all the time. And I mean, in this one, he's literally like blowing up like this huge storm. And I don't know, it occurred to me.
You know, but the whole battle is, you know, one of those, oh, I'm going to go get him first. Instead of, okay, let's plan this and all move in together.
Right.
I'm going to go, then you go. No, I'll take him now.
I wonder what we did back in the day when we were reading anything, you know, comics, books, whatever, and you would run across a reference that you had absolutely no idea what the hell it meant. What did we do back then before the internet came along? Did we just kind of go, eh, whatever, and just keep going?
Yeah, pretty much. Just kept moving through.
So same page, page 13, fourth panel. You've got this weird sequence where the Flash is running backwards. I forget why. Something's going on. I think he's being drawn to Grundy or something. But anyway,
the magic powers from Dr. Fate.
Okay. So yeah, he's running backwards and he's thinking to himself, when I wham into him at this speed, that Swampland Savage is going to be banged Galley West. I'm like, huh? So I looked this up. So Galley West is an informal expression typically used in the phrase knocked Galley West, meaning to be knocked unconscious, confused, or disoriented. It can also be used as an adjective, particularly in the northern U.S., to mean lopsided or cockeyed. The term is an altered version of the British dialect word Collie West, which means contrary or in the opposite direction. So basically, he's going to, you know, knock him away, I guess, is essentially what he's saying. But so I never heard that before.
So,
but you know what?
Like a 60s term or 50s term?
Yeah. I'm going to say a lot of times with things like that, you know, to retroactively answer your question now. I think, you try to take it in whatever context it was and then work from there. For example, one of Stan Lee's favorite things was that he'd have the bully call somebody a panty waist. I've never in my whole life ever heard anybody called a panty waist, but I figured out what it meant because of the context it was used.
Right.
I can't say I've never heard, but I've very, very, very rarely ever heard anybody called boy chick. But in Stan Lee's comics, he would use that one too.
Right.
And, I could kind of just take it from the context that it was given that I could understand that even at, 10 years old, 9 years old.
Milk toast or milk sop.
Milk sop.
Yeah, milk sop. Yeah.
And then I just laugh, and I mean, I know we're going off course here, but just, the names that people feel the need to call somebody, and they become so common in the comic book vernacular that if you have a tall person, you call them High Pockets. Like, where is that?
Right.
Who in real life ever does this?
Anyway. I know I'm probably the last guy that should ever be, like, fat shaming somebody, but I just, I have to point this out. Grundy's really put on a lot of weight for a dead guy that's been floating in space for a year and a half. I just have to say, he is a tub of shit in this episode. I mean, look at him at the bottom of page 13. What happened?
He was in space. There's no gravity. He lost his phone.
Oh,
you got to work out when you're in space.
Okay, that actually makes sense, except that he's dead. But I'll run with that. Page 16, let me flip to it here. Page 16, panel 2. The Spectre speculates that the antimatter man comes from, and I quote, an antimatter universe. Eventually it would be established that while there are an infinite number of positive matter universes, there was only one antimatter universe. That would be way down the road, though. But basically, for me, summing this one up, I think this issue is a lot of fun. I think it's fun. It's exciting. The art's still kind of substandard, but at least it's better than it has been up till now by Sikowski. But can you imagine this book with really kick-ass art?
Yeah.
Like, say, like Neil Adams or Murphy Anderson? Because, I mean, it is an epic threat. It's got all the ingredients. It just needs a little something, and I'm kind of wondering if maybe the little something could have been a touch up in the art.
I think they could have fleshed out the antimatter man a little bit. It's just like he has a zero personality,
right? So, when he comes back in Star Trek.
And just to go with your critique of Solomon Grundy on page 21 in the first panel, Blockbuster couldn't be more of a tub of lard than he is right there.
Right. Yeah.
And you've criticized, Blockbuster has been compared to the Hulk on occasion, and you've criticized, fat ass Hulk. And the problem with it is when you're drawn like that, it takes away from the seriousness of your visual threat.
Yeah.
It's one thing when you have a character like the Kingpin who they say, they think he's fat, but he's solid and whatever. That's not Blockbuster. That's not who we're talking about here. He's supposed to be this, hugely powerful, muscle-bound guy. So to draw him like all fat like that and then with his little weird haircut, it takes away from the epic nature of what, his appearance could be.
You're saying, how do I take this guy seriously?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Very much so. Yeah. Yeah. That's very true. Well, unless we have anything else, all I've got is where this has been reprinted. All right. So you can find this one reprinted in Justice League of America Archives, Volume 6, Hardcover 2000. Crisis on Multiple Earths, Volume 1, Trade Paperback, 2002. Showcase presents Justice League of America, Volume 3, Trade Paperback, 2008. Justice League of America, The Silver Age Omnibus, Volume 2, Hardcover, 2016. Crisis on Infinite Earths Box Set Hardcover, 2020. And Crisis on Multiple Earths Crossing Over Trade Paperback, 2021. Phew! All right, so published in between these two issues was Showcase number 64, starring the Spectre, which takes place after the conclusion of the issue that we're about to look at. Incidentally, we will not be covering Showcase number 64. While we are trying to be semi-authoritative, we're also trying to keep things moving along and not get bogged down in the weeds too much, and trying to avoid stories that, frankly, aren't all that great. And that's kind of that one, in my opinion. So we will be skipping over that one. So wrapping this whole thing up, we have Justice League of America number 47, cover dated September 1966. On sale date was July 26, 1966, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics. Cover price 12 cents. Cover credits, we have penciler was Mike Sikowski, inker Joe Gaiella. Depicts Batman punching out a gray whilst floaty heads of the JLA and JSA look on. Now, considering that the cover copy says to touch the antimatter man was to risk instant destruction, I'm not sure how smart this was for the so-called world's greatest detective to actually punch the guy, but whatever. Title on this one is The Bridge Between Earths. Writer was Gardner F. Fox, penciler Mike Sikowski, inker Sid Green, president of Spatula City. All right, so roll call on this one. Playing for the Justice League of America, we have Hawkman, Green Lantern, The Flash, Batman, and The Atom. For the Justice Society of America, we have Black Canary, Sandman, Wildcat, Dr. Midnight, The Spectre, and Dr. Fate. In his Ivy University lab, Ray Palmer finally figures out that it's his assistant's terrifying sounding space warping machine that is blocking his shrinking powers. So when she takes a break, he simply turns it off and assumes his superhero guise of the Atom. Meanwhile, on Earth 2, Blockbuster suddenly fades away and is replaced by Solomon Grundy, who goes immediately apeshit and starts busting up the place and people. Sandman starts whipping up cinder blocks and shooting them at Grundy, but the swamp zombie just bats them away at the heroes. So Dr. Fate magically transforms the deadly projectiles into custard pies. No, I'm not kidding. And a food fight ensues, which only accomplishes pissing off Grundy that much more. Back on Earth 1, those heroes, meaning the heroes of Earth 1, stand at the foot of the mountain Grundy had been encased in whilst it trembles and shakes. They think he's breaking loose, but are shocked when it's Blockbuster who smashes free. Without the mitigating influence of Bruce Wayne, the massive muscle-bound doofus absolutely mops the floor with them. Returning our attention to Earth 2, Dr. Fate, arguably the most powerful hero in this gathering, fucks off after having witnessed Grundy take out Batman, Sandman, and Wildcat all at once with a single bitch slap. He's gone to stare into his crystal orb where he sees the Spectre in quote-unquote warp space, trying his level best to keep Earths 1 and 2 from smashing into each other. Sensing that the Astral Avenger is weakening, though, Fate uses his magic to bring all of this adventure's heroes together in null space to battle the Antimatter Man. The JLA-JSA team-up puts up a valiant struggle, but it quickly becomes apparent that they cannot stop the Antimatter Man and that the Spectre is weakening quickly. Suddenly, it's the Atom to the rescue. The Mighty Might hatches a plan I don't quite follow. Something about rapidly shrinking and expanding the Spectre that'll stop the Earths from colliding somehow? Despite the real possibility of being blown to bits, the Spectre is willing to sacrifice himself to save the Earths and tells Atom to do it. The Atom shrinks the Spectre, then quickly reverses the process. The Spectre indeed explodes, and this somehow not only thrusts the Earths apart and back into their normal orbits, but blows the antimatter man back to his native universe too. Apparently, all of this was the fault of his assistant's space warping machine and not the antimatter man, I guess. Anyway, the Spectre is blowed up for all of four panels when we are reminded that, duh, he's a ghost, and he starts to reform himself. We aren't finished yet, the Flash reminds the assemblage. We still have Solomon Grundy and Blockbuster to take care of. Green Lantern tells them that they needn't worry about that. Just before Dr. Fate whisked them all away to battle the Antimatter Man, Green Lantern used his ring to pit the two monsters against each other, and they've been knocking the bejesus out of one another the whole time. The heroes arrive back on whatever the hell Earth this is all taking place on, just in time to see Grundy and Blockbuster awaken from having knocked each other out. They've also managed to knock the fight out of each other and decide to make friends. Suddenly, Grundy and Blockbuster are buddies, and all's well that ends well with true love conquering all, or something like that. The end. Phew. What do we think of this one, fellas?
I never thought I'd hear you say the Spectre blows the atom. The antimatter man. Away.
So to speak.
It just didn't seem to make sense as I read it. That's really my biggest criticism of it. Some of the artwork, again, I thought the artwork in the last issue was better than the artwork in this issue, first of all. In particular, I got to say, in both issues, Blockbuster is not served well at all.
No.
I particularly look on page, what is it? Six, I think it is. Yeah, page six in the middle panel.
Yes, I was just looking at that. Yeah.
That, I mean, it's terrible.
He looks like somebody that I can't quite.
Don't he looks say like who the it is because he hurt their feelings.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does.
Or even on page seven, Dr. Fate is kind of chunky.
Yeah.
But that was a more common body type in comics of this era.
He looks like he has his ass on backwards, doesn't he?
He does. So, again, I feel like this story is reaching for epic, but it's not quite getting there.
Yeah,
you know, it's building towards it. I give it a lot of credit, and when we do ratings at the end, I'm going to be giving some credit for the attempt, but I'm also going to take some away for the failure to actually get there. Then there was some things that, you know, just the what was it, the Black Canary's hair, which isn't that a wig?
Yes.
So how is she Rapunzeling her hair? I don't understand. You know, it's just confusing to me. And then the ending with, you know, apparently Solomon Grundy and Blockbuster becoming a couple. You know, it just didn't do it for me.
A power couple.
I guess. What would they... nowadays, they'd have to come up with a portmanteau. They'd be like... like Sockbuster.
That sounds disgusting.
So, I mean, again, points for trying. But I can only think the mindset was, we want to try and do something that's a little bit more epic. Now, this is coming out just a couple of months after the Fantastic Four had its Galactus trilogy. So, you know, I think Stan kind of expanded things into the cosmic way, or Stan and Jack, let me give credit where it's due, expanded things in a cosmic way there. And I think there's an effort to do that here as well. And it's pretty close in time, so I don't even think it's a direct response to that. But I also think that there's a thought process at DC that they don't want to go too far with it because their audience is still, you know, 8-year-olds, and we don't want to make this too epic for their minds to, you know, to digest.
Right.
So I think that those two goals kind of being at odds with each other hurt the way this was put together.
I can see that. You know, I mean, despite my my snarky synopsis, I dug this. I mean, I dug it a hell of a lot. I really did. But that's with, you know, the acknowledgement that I wouldn't want all my comics to be like this by any means. But this time around, it was fun. I had more fun with it than not. I'm not sure what the difference is compared to some of the other ones that we've looked at. Maybe time and distance a little bit. But also, I think it is kind of the epic threat, not necessarily the epic nature of it as it was all pulled off, but just the epic threat. I mean, it is attempting to do something big, you know, bigger than just, you know, we're you know, switching Earths to rob jewelry stores. Right. That's just not, I mean, that's not an epic thing to me. But this is, I mean, this is the imminent destruction of Earth 1 and Earth 2. So by the very nature of the threat, it makes it kind of an epic cosmic story. It's just how the whole thing ends up executed and all. But again, I can't help but wonder, I mean, if you had, you know, some really top-notch artistic talent on this, I kind of wonder if this has the potential to be one of those, you know, things that people look back on as, wow, that was a classic, you know? Unfortunately, that's not this. But I'd say, you know, as soon as I opened the cover on this and saw that opening title page, it was like an old friend dropping by. Because, you know, again, I've talked about this so many times in various shows. But, you know, I had a large collection of coverless comics when I was a kid because my parents and various uncles worked in paper mills. And they would bring me boxes of comics that were intended to be pulped, you know, to go to the pulper. And, you know, so this was just one of those ones I had. I've had this issue so long, I can't even remember when I ever got it or whatever, but it was one I finally, you know, was able to replace with a covered copy some years ago. But looking at the cover didn't really do anything for me. It was getting to that, you know, that opening splash and being like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, I remember this one. So part of it could have been rose-colored glasses too, because I did have fond memories of this one. I don't think I'd ever read the first chapter until I recently acquired it, but this one I remember from childhood.
The splash page looks to me like Blockbuster and Solomon Grundy are in some sort of dance-off contest.
Dance-off, bro. You and me.
Particularly Grundy. Looks like he's doing some sort of a step.
The art overall is much funnier in this book. I'm sure it wasn't intended to be funny.
Now, one of the things that confused me in this one is that Earth 1 and Earth 2 are not supposed to exist on the same plane.
Right.
They're supposed to be two, like, you know, you have to vibrate and go on the cosmic treadmill or whatever to get from one to the other. Whereas in this, it's being presented almost the way Marvel presented Counter-Earth, where it was a duplicate of Earth that was exactly, you know, exactly on the other side of the sun, so that you'd never see it. You know, they wouldn't be able to even discover that it existed, you know, with telescopes or whatever, because the sun was always in between them. Well, but that's the way this feels like, that they are on the same plane. It's just two different identical planets on the same plane, and that maybe doesn't make sense to me.
It's what's really, this is just a way to visualize,
yes,
them being brought into sync.
Yes,
that's and I would be okay with that if that's the way they explained it, but I didn't see anywhere where they explained it that
they
way.
Sent me an email.
I
wow, they were really ahead of their time.
See, I headcanon it the same way that Dave's saying, that we're not literally, they're not literally sharing the same plane any more than the Spectre is literally physically holding them apart with his body. Because if he was, he would be mashing, you know, with his hands and feet, millions of people to death, you know, because he's physically holding the, so that's not what's actually happening. I see this very much the same way that, you know, how it drives me crazy when people criticize Superman turning the Earth backwards in Superman the movie. Well, he doesn't actually turn the Earth backwards. It's a visualization of him traveling back in time. I see this the same way, is that the Spectre is not really physically holding these planets apart because they're not on the same plane, but because they're about to collide from two different realities, this is him using his Spectre power to keep them apart. I don't know. Does that follow? Because that's how I've always interpreted it.
It makes sense if it's presented that way. I just didn't think it was presented that way. And yeah, you can headcanon that, and I think that's fair. But I do think somewhere in the text boxes or whatever, they should have kind of clarified that a little bit, that this is a visualization of what is theoretically happening, but it is not
right
reality.
I agree. Yeah, I'll agree with you there. Absolutely. You know, you were talking about the art being funnier in this one. I think it starts right on the first page, because look at the floaty heads on the sides of the cover. Everybody looks massively depressed, and it just cracks me up. Like, look at Hawkman. That is the saddest looking Hawkman. He's a hog.
It looks like his mugshot.
Right.
And he's got a number under his picture.
Right. And then Wildcat's just got this look like, oh, damn it. He just looks so sad.
He needs more fiber, Wildcat.
You can tell Batmania was happening, because, you know, Batman's large and in charge on that cover, you know, almost as big as the Antimatter Man, baffing him right in the face, even though that would mean instant destruction. It's a good cover, though. I like the cover.
I love that they put the heads on the cover.
Yep. Yeah, I like that. Was this the first one to do that? I should have been making note of that. I think this might have been. I forget. I'd have to look back at the other ones, though.
Jump to page 3 and take a look at some of those. The first panel, it looks like Bruce has no shirt on. He just got a big bat medal on his chest. And panel 2, I'm not even going to say what's going through my mind looking at the faces on these. Oh, it was a happy ending after all.
I guess. In the on that opening splash page, there was just, I don't know, this is just weirdly worded. It says, for you Johnny Come Latelys who missed the first half of this extravaganza, we'll clue you in that certain people and superheroes have been mysteriously switching from Earth 1 to Earth 2 and vice versa. Vice versa? What?
I think they're trying to be funny.
What are we, 3? Okay, now go back to page 3, though. Now, you have a good point in the art, and one of the things in the art that's really made me crazy on this page. Okay, so I know I already said it regarding this, you know, this whole thing last issue. I just feel like it bears reiterating. These sand powers are really stupid that Sandman has. Why the hell would his sand gun form blocks that look exactly like cinder blocks? Why wouldn't it just form solid blocks? But it literally forms cinder blocks. And, you know, cinder blocks have the openings in them. So I don't know. Does that just seem really stupid to anybody else? Why wouldn't it just form like bricks?
Yeah.
Like a big solid block.
Right. I agree.
How's it's about every dumb. Time someone suddenly changes Earth, Wildcat gets punched in the face?
He got punched so hard that it straightened his ears out. Did you notice that? So panel 2 of page 4, it says, and so, like an old, like a wild scene in an old-time slapstick comedy, a custard pie brawl, and I'm thinking, yeah, that's exactly the problem with this, is like a wild scene in an old-time slapstick comedy. It's like, at least it doesn't go on ridiculously long. It's just really the one panel. And
he slaps the three of them out, Grundy.
My mother used
to be able to do that when my cousins were over. One swipe of the hand got everybody.
Page 6. Panel 2. You've got Black Canary grabs a hold of Blockbuster's hand and says, "I'll judo throw you like pant pant, like a," and she's struggling to do it while he's going, "Yeah, yeah," making all kinds of goofy Arnold Schwarzenegger noises. I would just like to remind the writers on this that this is the same woman that they had defeat Superwoman in a prior crossover. Suddenly she can't judo toss Blockbuster.
It does look like she dislocated his elbow. Look at his arm.
Yeah, that is some wonky anatomy there. Very wonky.
What is that thing in panel 3? Is that an 8-ball someone threw at him?
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Where the hell did that come from?
It's the magic 8-ball.
From Billiard Ball Man.
It is an 8-ball. I don't know where the hell it's supposed to be coming from because they're out at the volcano at this point. So, I don't.
It's like, for the hell of it, I'm throwing an 8-ball.
Yeah. I didn't even catch that. You're right. It's there plain as day, too. And I never even really, I mean, I saw it, but it just didn't register. Like, wait, what? Somebody literally threw an 8-ball at him. That would hurt.
God.
Now, that same panel, you've got Dr. Midnight saying, "I'll operate on him with my chirotuber." Now, not only am I really tired of his stupid medical puns, but I can't think of many things in my life more terrifying than a blind man firing a gun anywhere near my general direction.
Yeah. Doc, why don't you go sit in the corner? Let the grown-ups handle this.
Page 7, panel 2. This time, Fate says the antimatter universe. So maybe that gets established a little bit quicker than I thought it did. But yeah, they kind of fluctuate back and forth in this one, whether there's, you know, it's the antimatter universe or an antimatter universe. But eventually that would get nailed down. Fate summons all the heroes with no problem after making such a big, you know, after such a big deal was made about not being able to do this in the last issue. I thought that was kind of weird.
And you're right. It definitely looks like his ass is on back. I keep hearing Mel Brooks saying, "How come no one told me my ass is getting so big?"
Well, you've heard the expression ass backwards before. So
right. Yeah, there you go.
This is what they're talking about, apparently.
Now, according to the DC Wiki, the Antimatter Man is from Kord. And that's another thing that would be retconned later on. Kord being the antimatter universe. So.
I misspoke about the last issue. It was Flash's feet that were made really big.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Yeah. So he couldn't run or something like that. Yeah.
They're so heavy, he can't move them.
I mean, I could have spent like the next year making notes on this thing. So I finally had to just kind of cut myself off because it there's a lot of weirdness in this one. But the last panel in this, page 24, last panel, or actually next to last panel, Adam is talking about his assistant. He says, what about, and I can't even pronounce this woman's name. He says, what about his assistant? Essentially, he says,
Enrichetta
Negrini, I guess.
Negrini.
Do you think we should ask her to give up her space warp experiments? And
well, duh.
Somebody, I guess this is Batman answering. I'm trying to trace where the word balloon's coming from. I guess Batman, it's either Batman or somebody off panel says, no, Adam, risk is a necessary and calculated risk. That makes no sense, but that's what the sentence is. Risk is a necessary and calculated risk of all scientific research. And then Flash says, in her particular case, what's her face? Never realized she was tampering with the forces and blah, blah, blah. And they go on. And I'm thinking, no, no, no. Somebody, and probably Batman, should have said, Adam, he should have said, you know, bitch could have killed everyone on two Earths. Make her stop. Make her knock that off. I mean, because it was that you know they end up establishing at the end of this that it was her invention that caused all of this. So wait, risk is part of the process?
After Batman says that he lights a cigarette, it's the 60s. I'm going to have a couple of drinks. You want one for the road, and then we'll go home.
That was the moment for me. Look at
on the panel, the middle panel on that last page. Is it me or is Flash giving Blockbuster the stink eye?
Look at Blockbuster. He looks flat ridiculous.
Well, look at Solomon Grundy in the panel above it.
Yep.
I'm glad I'm not Dr. Fate, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, the art's
I don't
a little wonky in this one.
Green Lantern looks the same twice in the whole book.
He got a big old forehead in that last panel.
In the one before on page 22, it looks like he's saying, "I'm a real boy."
Solomon Grundy seems like he's had a degradation of intelligence too, because by the end of this, he and Blockbuster are just about on the same mental level as they're like patting each other on the back and giving each other, you know, they become buddies. And Solomon just goes, "Us be friends." This is the same guy that was leading a mob the last time we saw him. He was like the leader of his little gang. And now he's not smart enough to form intelligent sentences anymore. So something's happened to him.
Well, I don't care how simple the other guy is. Grundy's still a rotting corpse. You'd want to hug that?
Yeah, I guess. That's all I got on this, though. Despite all the criticisms, I still did dig it. It was fun. At the end of the day, I did have fun reading it, as goofy as it is. And I totally could make no sense of the Adams plan with the Spectre. I'm still not exactly sure how the hell all that worked, but it was still fun looking at it.
It was a lot of fun.
Did we want to do grades on these?
Yeah.
All right. Dave, you got the first book. You go first.
All right. I'm going to do this quick and dirty. I wasn't a big fan of the cover. I get, you know, I'm a little dense. I didn't catch that it was Batmania, but yeah, it's definitely Batmania. The interactions with the words, though, Powell was sock and thud, where you see Wildcat getting punched through the O. Grundy's hand is through the O on sock, and Batman and Sandman are crushing the thud. For me, it's a little over the top. Grundy really looks like he's unique. Let's put it that way. I gave the cover a C+.
Do you remember when Scooby-Doo and they had the Addams Family in one of the Scooby-Doo yes. movies?
Yeah.
Wasn't there one of the Addams Family members that looked like
Lurch.
Grundy looks? Yeah.
Lurch. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what it reminds me of.
I wouldn't be surprised if there was a certain... I know Grundy's around a while, right? He goes all the way back to...
Yeah.
But the Addams Family was on TV at this time, I think. Yeah, so I wouldn't be surprised if there was a little, let's lurch up Grundy.
Maybe.
The cover I gave a C+. The interior art, I think, was a significant step up. And I really enjoyed it. And I gave the interior art a solid B+. The story I thought was fun. I liked they brought back, you know, a lot of the creatures, not creatures, characters. The one weakness I really found with the story, other than some of the goofiness, is the need they felt to introduce all these new gadgets to the old heroes. And I'm pretty sure we don't ever see most of these gadgets
right.
ever again, and for good reason. I also got a kick out of, you know, the presumptions made where it's like, oh, I was chasing a fur truck. Now it's an armored car. It's got to be criminals. But that's par for the course. But overall, I did enjoy the story, and I gave it a solid B+. And I'm going to give this an overall B.
All right. I will give mine for this. I do not care for the cover at all on this one. Now, I can see why they did it during the time period, because this probably would have sold well, I would think, at that time, with, you know, Batmania being a big thing and all that. But, you know, just looking at it with modern eyes and everything, it does nothing for me. As a matter of fact, looking at this cover made me like audibly groan when it was time to read this, because I was like, oh God. Thankfully, the issue was so much better than the cover, but the cover is the weak part of this. I just think it's a really poor cover. I think I'm going to give it a D-, because everything about it just puts me off. The coloring, the anatomy, the artwork, the character model, everything, and just nothing of the cover really works for me.
When you groaned, was there a big ugh above your head?
Right, exactly. However, the interior art, I was pretty surprised opening this up and digging into the story that this was still Mike Sekowski, but somehow dude got his shit together, because this is a hell of a lot better than we've seen up to this point by Mike Sekowski. And I'm sorry to keep dumping on the guy, but I just, up to this point, I have just not enjoyed his art. But this one wasn't bad, I generally enjoyed it. I mean, sure, it still has some wonky anatomy and, the weakest points of this, honestly, are Grundy and Blockbuster. They're way too beefy and fat and weird looking. But otherwise, the other characters generally look pretty darn good, especially Batman, I thought, looked pretty good. And I, you know, even though he's a really goofy, weird character, I kind of like the design of the Antimatter Man as well. I thought he was kind of cool. So overall, artistically, it's a lot better than it has been. So I think I will go I'll say a B- on the art, because it was much better than we've seen up to this point. And then story-wise, it's goofy and all, but I like that we're finally getting the level of threat I feel like we should be getting for these two teams getting together. So it scores a lot of points for me in that aspect. So story-wise for this particular issue, I will also go a B- on that. For an overall grade, I think, of a B-. So basically I'm sparing the cover from the grade on this, but again, terrible cover. But otherwise, yeah, pretty solid issue. Paul?
I'm not as down on the cover as you are, even though I do not think it's really all that good. I think Blockbuster is drawn better on this cover than he is anywhere in these two issues, which is not really setting the bar very high, I realize, but, you know, I'm going to take that as a positive. I don't like the playing with the Batmania thing, because this isn't a Batmania type story. It's not like a Pow Sock Thud story. No. So, you know, the cover is almost misleading if it's making you think that that's what you're going to get. I also think Solomon Grundy looks really silly.
Yep.
I'm going to say a C. It's not horrible, but it's just, it doesn't work. So I'm just going to give it a C. The interior art, I think, is a step up from the cover, certainly. It's a little, you know, there's a couple of parts that I'm not crazy about, but overall, I think it tells the story fairly well. So I'm going to say, it's not great, but I'm gonna say a B- on the art. I don't think it's terrible. It's not bad. It's just not as, you know, it's not great. And the story, I think I would give this story probably a C+, but I am going to give it some points for attempting to come up with a threat that's, you know, world threatening, well, multiple world threatening. So the fact that it did that, I'm going to give it just a B. I'm not going to even give it a B-. I'm going to give it a B because, you know, a B for effort. Wait, that doesn't go, does it? But whatever, that's what I'm going with. And I'm going to give this the book overall a B minus.
Cool. For issue 47, I like the cover a lot better on this one. Again, I think, you know, you have to take into account that it's just as misleading as the prior issue's cover, because, you know, Batman is not as big as the Antimatter Man. He never grows to be as big as him. You know, he never baffs him in the face like he is on the Batman is just another character in the story. He's not front and center. He's not the main guy, but you'd never know that from, you know, this cover. It makes it look like Batman's the man in this one. But it is a much better cover, and I always like the ones where they have the floaty heads of the teams on either side. So I do like this cover much better. I think I'll say a C plus on this particular cover. Interior art, I'm having a tough time deciding whether I think it's better, not as good, or about the same as the prior issue art wise. I mean, it's the same team and everything. And in certain instances, I do feel like it's a little bit better. And then other instances, I feel like it's not as strong. So it's kind of weird in that way. But overall, I think it's better than we've seen up to this point by Sikowski. So overall, I like it. I think with this one, I'm just going to go a C plus on the art, though. I do think it's a little bit weaker than the prior issue, but not by much. I think really what it comes down to, as I flip back and forth here, I think a lot of it's the anatomy. I don't think the anatomy is quite as strong as the issue before, and the anatomy wasn't real strong in that one to begin with. So, the story is a lot of fun. I think this is the goofier chapter, even though this is, you know, where the threat really escalates, because the Earths are getting that much closer and everything feels more, supposed to be anyway, more tension filled and, you know, coming to its big ultimate climax. But somehow it's also sillier at the same time. So story wise, I feel like it suffers a bit in that aspect. So I'll also drop the story down to a C plus rather. But overall, I still really dug it. I had a hell of a fun time reading it. So, I think an overall grade for the book, I will still go a B minus. It's slightly stronger than the sum of its parts. And I overall, you know, the two part crossover, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun. I hope the next one's more serious and better drawn than this one. I don't want to keep seeing the same thing over and over, but you know, as a one-shot type of adventure, it was fun for its silliness.
I'll go next.
Okay. Oh. Go ahead.
I'm going to do it quick and dirty. Cover I liked better than the last one. I really love the roll call on the cover. Granted, the Batman scene is not in the book, but I still enjoyed this cover more than the other one. I gave it a B, I'd say a B minus on the cover. The interior art to me was a bigger step down. It's just wacky. And I think I beat it to a point with, from Blockbuster becoming the Heat Miser to Hal Jordan doesn't look the same twice, Fate with his backwards ass. I went with this. I'm going to give the interior art a C minus. The story is wacky, but it's at the point where it's become so wacky it's entertaining.
Right.
So, I mean, I you know, if you were to sit down and go, well, you know, this just couldn't happen in the real world. No kidding. But it's an entertaining read, and it's fun, and it's nostalgic. I gave the story a solid B minus. Now I'm going to give this book overall a B minus.
I like the cover much more than the previous one. I think this is the kind of cover that actually would have made me see it on the stands and say, oh, I want this issue. I don't like the fact that we don't see what's on the cover in the book, because it kind of is pretending that we will. But other than that, I'd say this is a B cover. I'd say it's pretty solid, and it would, again, it would entice me into wanting to buy it. The interior art, I'm with Dave on it. It's a little too inconsistent, and it's a little too wacky at parts, and the anatomy is poor in areas. I'm going to go with the C minus on that as well. The story, I'm going to give this part, even though, see, this part had the daunting task of wrapping up what they created, and I think, you know, that's always the harder part of writing a story. But I think, you know, it's silly and it doesn't make sense, but it wraps it up in an entertaining way. So I'm going to give this one the same grade I gave the previous one and give it a B for the story. And overall, I'm going to give a C plus to this one. Not quite as good as the last one, but still, you know, above average.
Cool. All right. This final chapter, Justice League of America 47, was reprinted in all the same volumes as previously stated for issue 46, plus one bonus reprinting. It was reprinted in Justice Society of America, a celebration of 75 years hardcover in 2015. How you can reprint part of the story, I don't know, but that's what they did. Next time on Legends of the Justice Society of America, we're going to be covering Atom number 29 and Green Lantern number 52 from February and April 1967, respectively.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.